From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the secret energy of animals. If you have a pet, you're going to love the last 2 hours. Here's what's happening. Without any Republican support, the House on Wednesday night voted to impeach President Donald Trump on the abuse of power and obstruction of Congress related to his dealings with the Ukraine, making him, Mr. Trump, the third American president ever to be impeached. The other two, of course, back in 1868, Andrew Johnson was impeached. 1998, Bill Clinton was impeached. None of them convicted in the Senate. We'll see what happens with Mr. Trump. Now, a fourth president, President Richard Nixon, was about to be impeached, but he resigned. Well, now the job goes to the Senate of conducting the trial. It's supposed to be in January, but there is some talk now that the Democrats are playing around with these articles of impeachment and might delay the trial. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Well, John, something you and I had predicted, it would go to the Senate for a trial, and it looks like it's going to happen.
Well, this is the most partisan exercise in the history of impeachments. It's basically taking the impeachment process, which is an article, as you know, it's an Article One power. It's weaponizing it, essentially, and using it for purely partisan purposes. The Democrats have violated their own principles on impeachment when they said that they would need bipartisan support to move forward with impeachment. They got not only no Republicans on this, and they also had three or four defections from Democrats. Now, what does this tell you? What it tells you is that in order for you to believe that the case against Donald Trump, as presented by Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler in the Intelligence and the Judiciary Committees, you have to believe that every Republican elected official is violating their oath of office in order to defend Donald Trump. That's what you would have to believe. It's absolutely preposterous that this impeachment has gone on in this partisan manner. If you read the letter that Trump wrote just 2 days ago to Nancy Pelosi, that she said it shows that he's insane, you will read one of the more cohesive, coherent descriptions of a defense against this abomination of the Constitution, basically, saying they're protecting the Constitution. They have done everything except protect the Constitution. They have weaponized their power under Article One in order, under the most extreme circumstances, when somebody's committed a high crime misdemeanor or other high crimes and misdemeanors, meaning it could be larceny, it could be theft, it could be domestic battery, it could be a whole variety of things, but not the vagueness of abuse of power or obstruction of Congress. The president had every right not to respond to these willy-nilly, just absolutely inappropriate subpoenas by the House, and for that they refer to him as this is obstruction of Congress. This will go down in history as a deep stain, and let me tell you, the polling, the recent polling that's been done over the last couple of days by USA Today and a number of other polling organizations have shown that Trump's numbers in the battleground states are surging by 10-point majority margins against all of the Democrat opponents in this next election. And I would tell you that if they delay this any further, I think it will be an utter landslide on Election Day.
You may be right, John. We're going to watch this and continue to watch it. Well, Russia's top general has warned a big war is coming and a chilling prediction amid ongoing tensions with NATO. The chief of Vladimir Putin's general staff has said he believes the West preparing for a large-scale military conflict. I don't think so, but let's hope he's wrong. For the first time, researchers have assessed the impact on the risk of heart or blood vessel problems with a combination of sleep patterns and genetic susceptibility to cardiovascular disease. The study, which is published in the European Heart Journal, found that even if people had a high genetic risk of heart disease or stroke, this appeared to be offset to some extent by good sleep patterns. How about that? Of course, we work strange hours, don't we? As I reported yesterday, for many years, chili has been hailed for its therapeutic properties, and now the researchers have found that eating chili peppers regularly can cut the risk of death from heart disease and stroke. The study, carried out in Italy, where chili is a common ingredient, compared the risk of death among 23,000 people, some of whom ate chili and some of whom did not. Participants' health status and eating habits were monitored over 8 years, and researchers found that the risk of dying from a heart attack was 40% lower among those eating chili peppers at least four times a week. I thought we'd check in with our expert on heart problems, Christian Wild, myheartbook.com. Christian, why is this about chili?
It's amazing, George, and it's been going on. These studies have been going on for many, many years. Yeah, those of you who have my book, Hidden Causes, on page 336 is a whole chapter on the benefits of chili and capsaicin that inside the chili that actually keeps you from having the heart attack or the stroke. George, if we can just look at the statistics for 2019, 840,750 heart attack deaths. Of this number, 720,000 were first-time heart attacks, and some 335,000 were repeated attacks and strokes, which amounted to 800,000. So are we overlooking a simple factor that could, according to this and other studies, interrupt a significant number of these deaths with a dietary compound that has saved thousands and thousands of lives in countries like Italy and South America, who include hot chili peppers in their everyday diets? Those of okay now that capsaicin, which is the compound, can interrupt and bring survival to many stroke and heart attack victims.
That's amazing.
So this would be a good time to say, time is not in the favor of the victim, so if someone is exhibiting symptoms, don't delay. Call the paramedics. Nothing could be worse than standing around nervously, doing nothing, waiting for the paramedics to arrive. So after calling for help, now instead of just standing there, you might put a spoonful of cayenne in a glass of water. And believe it or not, that simple act can break that clot, can save the life, your life, or the life of someone you love. According to the researchers, it would be helpful in dissolving that clot. And as I continually say, it's not the heart that causes the ischemic heart attack. It's not the brain that causes the stroke. It is a tiny clot of blood feeding the blood to the heart and the brain that are the actual cause. Keeping that blood from clotting, which you do with the cayenne. I remember Dr. Julian Whitaker, maybe 15 years ago, I remember him saying that he takes two capsules a day. And there are companies like Solaray that produce a cool cayenne. So the main factor is that clot.
It's pretty dramatic.
Stroke causes the heart attack.
I love it. Christian, thanks. His website, myheartbook.com. What a story. Well, they say that trolls targeted people with epilepsy on Twitter with seizure-inducing videos. My gosh, what's wrong with people? According to the Epilepsy Foundation, the U.S. charity said that the perpetrators had posted flashings and strobing videos in November. The Epilepsy Foundation's own Twitter handle and hashtag had been used in order to target people with epilepsy. Jeez, Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the Internet. What's wrong with people, Lauren?
This is one of those stories that makes you wonder whether human beings really deserve to exist in this universe at all. Huh?
I mean, unbelievable.
How low can you go? It's astounding. So what's happening here, of course, is we know that people that have photosensitive epilepsy, a certain percentage of them are susceptible to seizures triggered by flashing lights, strobes, specific kinds of patterns at specific rates. So, yeah, apparently what happened here, and this isn't the first time this sort of thing has occurred, though this may be the largest attack. Autoplay GIF files that autoplay by default in Twitter in some configurations were sent out in a way that targeted the Epilepsy Foundation's Twitter feed. So they would appear in the feed and comments and hashtags and such. And it's pretty evil. And the Epilepsy Foundation has gone to law enforcement about this. They're not just sitting still for it. One takeaway from this is that to remember when you have the ability to do so, and in most platforms you do, it can be a good idea to disable autoplay GIFs. I mean, even if you don't have epilepsy, they're not dangerous to you. They're usually very annoying, if nothing else. Turn them off. But when you see GIFs being weaponized this way, this isn't a funny thing. This isn't a joke. This isn't something that's silly. Not even something that's obscene. It's something that could kill people. And really, that's so far beyond the pale that it's hard to even come up with a way to conceive the kind of thinking of people that would do something like that. So as a short-term measure, certainly if you have epilepsy, if you have photosensitive epilepsy, you should try to disable autoplay GIFs wherever you can. That will help avoid them just being suddenly presented to you. And hopefully the foundation will have some luck in tracking down the people that were behind this particular attack.
Let's hope so. Thanks, Lauren. Here's another strange story. The International Association of Exorcists has issued a statement warning the parents of the dangers of a 2019 children's book that gives instructions on how to summon up demons. The statement refers to a children's book of demons, a book targeting children ages 3 to 10. Be careful if your child has that book. That's a strange story. It's in our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. And after the sudden death of their daughter last week, one family has taken the unusual step of enlisting others at a California megachurch to attempt to bring the child back to life. Since Saturday, members of the Bethel Church in Reading have been using prayer, music, and singing in this effort. Andrew and Kelly, their two-year-old daughter, Olive, died early Friday morning after she stopped breathing. They are now hoping that prayer, song, and praise will revive her. My gosh, what a story. We'll keep our eyes on that. The European CHOPS Space Telescope has launched to study planets outside our solar system. The observatory will follow up the discoveries of previous missions, endeavoring to reveal fresh insights on the nature of distant worlds. Congress, of course, adopts the defense bill that creates the Space Force. They piggybacked it on another federal workers' plan to create some potential parental leave money for federal workers. Nonetheless, Congress has approved a compromise defense bill which creates the new Space Force. But what is this Space Force? Robert Zubrin with us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Robert Zubrin back with us, president of Pioneer Astronautics and the Mars Society, as well as a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. Robert has studied and researched in the fields of aerospace and energy. He has a Ph.D. in nuclear engineering as well. He's a favorite guest here on Coast to Coast. How many years you been on the program now, Robert? My gosh.
Quite a few. I don't know, but 20.
Goes way back. It goes way back. And how are you? How's the family? Everything good?
Everything's good. My daughter's back from Indonesia. She's in graduate school now, and happy dad.
Super. So it looks like the money for the Space Force is going to go through. Tell us about the Space Force, Robert.
Well, okay.
And how much money are we talking about for this? It's another branch of the military, right?
Right. Well, to start with, it's not that much extra money. The real issue, because we've already have space forces, okay? There's Air Force Space Command, which has been fulfilling the functions that are now going to be assigned to the Space Force. So in one sense, you could just say, well, this is just a change in the organizational chart, okay? But that was, for instance, true of the creation of the Air Force out of the Army Air Corps in 1947. But creating a space force creates a group of people who are focused on the issue of how to achieve, not just do things in space, but achieve space superiority and even space supremacy over all potential opponents. And the difference between those two things is space superiority is just having better space assets than adversaries. Space supremacy means you have all the assets and you can deny them having any. Okay?
Well, it appears, you know, we live by satellites in space. We get our cable television, we get our satellite television, we get our cell phones, we get our computers and internets. Everything's done by satellite these days, Robert. If they go down, we go down, don't they?
Right. It's true, but it's even more forceful than that. See, we've had space assets for a while, I mean, but in all the wars the United States has fought since there was space assets, we were fighting in conflicts that would have ended. In ours, we fought Saddam Hussein. If we didn't have satellites, we still would have beaten them, okay? So it seems like a thrill. Okay, it's cool. We definitely like it, but it's not decisive. But imagine if you were in a war against a comparable opponent, like World War II. Okay,
yep.
Imagine if in World War II, the Axis powers, Germany and Japan, had reconnaissance satellites and we didn't. Okay, and reconnaissance satellites is just one part of space capabilities. Well, if they had reconnaissance satellites, the Japanese would have spotted our fleets at the Battle of Midway long before we saw them. They would have taken out our aircraft carriers and then wiped out the rest of the ships from the air without difficulty. So they would have won the Pacific War. Any American ship trying to leave and going out to sea would have been spotted by them and taken out. Same thing, the Germans, the U-boats would have won the war of the Atlantic. Britain would have been starved out. They would have had to surrender. The Russians would have been defeated because any Soviet tank concentrations would have been spotted on the steppes long before they could do anything. So in other words, just that one space capability would have reversed World War II. And even an opponent as mismatched against the United States as Japan was. I mean, Japan had some capability, but, you know, they weren't really in our class, and they still could have beaten us. So today we have reconnaissance satellites, we have GPS satellites, which are used not just for navigation of ground forces, they're used to guide munitions, and GPS-guided missiles are 100 times more accurate than those without GPS guidance. So, in other words, the people firing them get 100 times as many hits for the same amount of firepower, and so on. And then, yes, there's the communication and coordination of forces. So if one side or the other, if there was a major conventional war, whoever has the dominance of space wins, period.
Oh, there's no question about that. The need to do this, I think, is essential. I have a feeling we might have this for some time already. What do you think about that?
Well, as I said, we've had space forces, and they've been mostly lodged in the Air Force Space Command, and the Navy has also had some space forces. But the difference is this, is that in the Air Force, the space forces are a junior branch. You know, the people who really run the Air Force are people who are fighter pilots, and they're the ones that get respect. They're, you know, because, of course, they have to, unlike the Space Force people who work behind desks, they fight pilots. They're like the knights of the air, right? They're real men. They risk their lives, and that is true. And so The Space Force is within the context of such an organization cannot be taken are not taken fully seriously, and so having their own force, where you know merit for promotion will be seen as doing the kind of things that allow the Space Force to win its battles, which are not so much physical courage, but perhaps mental courage of being willing to break from the pack and break from the consensus and propose things that, that are not part of the party line but are really necessary.
Hold on, Robert. We're at the break. We'll come back and talk more about the Space Force on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Robert Zubin with us. His latest book is called The Case for Space. Robert, how are we going to get the secret Space Force up there? Are we going to take it up with privatization? I mean, that sounds strange.
Well, the Space Force will be launched with whatever launch vehicles are available. And in fact, the entrepreneurial space revolution spearheaded by SpaceX is going to give us a significant advantage. Because in the past 10 years, SpaceX, as a result of introducing reusable rockets and also lower overhead methods of production, has cut the cost of space launch by a factor of five. And, for instance, in 2018, they launched 24 rockets that year, which is to say twice a month they were launching. They're launching you know, about as many as the whole rest of the United States put together by themselves. And the rest of the United States includes much larger companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, and as well as some smaller ones. But the look, in a space conflict with against a capable opponent, you're going to take losses. They're going to take losses. The side that can replace their losses faster is going to prevail.
Now, what about Russia and China? What are they doing towards getting their own space force?
Well, in fact, this is a real issue because, see, first of all, number one, the United States armed forces are much more dependent on space assets than either the Russians or the Chinese. That's point one. So they recognize that it's a capability of ours, but it's also a vulnerability of ours. So they have been working on anti-satellites they could launch up into space and then come close to our satellites and blow up and then take out our key space assets. Now, the Obama administration thought they could avoid this development by setting a good example and not developing ASATs of our own. That did not work. The Russians and Chinese have been proceeding on developing ASATs, and we need ASATs too, but that itself is not enough because if they destroyed our satellites and we destroyed their satellites, they win, okay? What is needed, what we need are what I call fighter satellites. I talk about this in one of the chapters in The Case for Space, in fact. You know, a fighter airplane protects your bombers and your AWACS and other air assets, and it also can be used to take out the other side's aircraft. So the and you know what was decisive for us in World War II was when we started flying fighter escorts with our bombers. Then they became really effective. Before that, they took massive losses and in exchange for limited damage. So we need satellites that can fly near our satellites and protect them against approaching ASATs.
Now, in 1957, the Russians launched Sputnik. Since then, there are today about 5,000 satellites orbiting the Earth. 5,000, Robert? What, don't they collide?
Very rarely, because there's a lot of space in space. It's really big. I mean, if you can imagine, 5,000 sounds like a lot, but imagine that there were only 5,000 cars on Earth. How many times would there be auto accidents?
We wouldn't have rush hours in L.A., that's for sure.
Right. Okay. So, you know, and then space is actually bigger than the surface of the Earth because, you know, it's got a second floor and a third floor and a fourth floor and 199th floor. I mean, it's not just one layer. It's got volume.
How would you form the Space Force? If you were given the task, how would you put it together? And what would the missions be?
Well, as I say, the starting point is Air Force Space Command. And in fact, Space Force is going to be kind of under the wing of the Air Force, at least for a while, in the same sense, I think, as like the Marines are under the wing of the Navy. The separate organization, but in another sense, still within the larger.
Kind of reporting, too. That's right.
Yeah. And the, so, you know, the people are there right now. You put them in their own group. But as I say, now promotions and priorities can be focused within the mental framework of the struggle for space supremacy. And, you know, certain kinds of merit that are absolutely critical in a force like the Air Force, including, you know, virtuosity at fighter combat and physical courage and, of course, in the Army, physical strength, are not really that important in the Air Force, in the Space Force. What's important there, okay, is engineering ingenuity and originality, creativity, and yes, hard work, of course, is valuable in all of the forces. But, you know, a lot of times in a technical organization and you get a certain set of ideas are accepted and someone has to fight for some new ideas, it's a different kind of courage. It's kind of a moral courage of being able to break with a party line and say, no, this is what we need. And, of course, not all those people are right. Sometimes they're wrong. But when someone does have that kind of courage and they're right, well, those are the people you want to promote. So that's the kind of force you'll have. One thing that's interesting about the Space Force, I think, is because it does not involve physical strength and most of the unique attributes that ground or sea or air combat have involved, it will be a force in which women will be able to participate on an equal level with men.
No question about it. As of right now, we have about 500,000 active duty reservists and Air National Guard members of the Air Force, 500,000. What would that increase to, in your opinion, at a full-blown Space Force? How many people would be devoted to that, given the fact that we've got 500,000 in the traditional Air Force right now?
Well, the Space Force would be smaller than that.
5,000 guys, men and women?
I think somewhere between 20 and 50,000.
Would they be all astronauts types?
No, it would be more engineers types. Most space combat in general is going to be done by unmanned satellites.
Really? Okay, so you're not going to need somebody in a spaceship pointing a laser at another satellite and zapping it. It's going to be done by robots.
For the most part. I mean, someday there might be a need for a piloted military spacecraft, either for direct combat or for deployment of satellites or for fixing of satellites. And this kind of thing, I could see a role of that kind. But, you know, a lot of the, you know, the satire on the Space Force by opponents have, you know, painted it in this sort of Buck Rogers realm. And really, it'll be more the kind of thing of satellite jockeys, okay, and, you know, designing them, building them, launching them, and operating them, and developing tactics for them because I imagine if there's actually space combat, it won't just be one individual satellite moseying up close to another and engaging. There'll probably be squadrons and there'll be all sorts of tactics that people will have to think up.
What would it take, Robert, for us to take out satellites of other countries? What kind of altercation, what situation scenario would have to occur?
Well, I mean, in one sense, you know, people say, isn't it horrible taking war into outer space? And yeah, but if you're going to have a war, I can't think of a better place to have it. The least collateral damage. I mean, if there was an adversary that was gearing up to attack us, One way to on the ground and sea and air, if we made a preemptive move and took out all their space assets, we could basically say, checkmate, better not do anything because we can see you and you can't see us.
How many of these 5,000 satellites could be Russian or Chinese, and how do we know who's who?
Well,
that's a tough one.
That is to some extent, and I'm sure there are methods that I am not read into. Of course, many satellites are known simply because they've been tracked ever since they were launched. And I don't think we actually have 5,000 operational, that there are 5,000 operational satellites. I think it's more like 3,000, because I think 5,000 have been launched, but not all are still working. Now, of course, the numbers are going to increase rapidly. Elon Musk is busy at work creating a satellite constellation of his own called Starlink, which will be 3,000 satellites by itself.
When they launch, Robert, I want to come back to the question about how will we know who's who, but when they launch, how do they know they're not going to ram into a satellite with these 3,000 to 5,000 active satellites out there? How do they know they're not going to collide with one?
Well, as I say, it's rare. I mean, just once again, you know, there's over a billion cars on Earth, okay? I don't know the exact number. But, you know, it's 200 million in the United States alone, okay? If there were only 5,000 cars on Earth, even if they were moving randomly, they'd hardly ever hit each other.
Okay, I see what you mean. I see. And
as I say, space is much bigger than the Earth. Now, in terms of identifying them, first of all, we could always know which are ours by just having, you know, secret beacons on them that mm-hmm. would say, you know, friend or foe, right?
So we don't shoot our own down.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure that might happen once in a while. We do that in regular combat. But in general, no, we would have a way of knowing who is us and who is British and who's other friends and who aren't. In general, I mean, look, you know, you have a fighter satellite on patrol with one of our reconnaissance satellites, and it's approached by something that looks like an ASAT. We know it's not ours, and we know it's coming towards us, and it presents a potential hazard. Well, you could interrogate it, you know, who are you, what are you doing, stop, or you could just take it out.
How far ahead is Elon Musk's SpaceX from Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin?
A lot, I would say. Musk has been moving much faster. I mean, Bezos has much larger resources. But, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, the word genius is frequently attached to Musk, but we don't usually hear the word wisdom attached to him that often. However, in this one sense, I would, because he understands something that very few people understand until they're much older than him, which is that they're not going to live forever.
Right.
And he is acting like he knows that he's not going to live forever. Bezos apparently thinks he's going to live forever. In other words, he has infinite money, so he thinks he has infinite time, but nobody has infinite time.
No, maybe he thinks he's going to clone his body and download his memory or something.
I don't know. But I mean, look, Musk has substantial resources, but they're not infinite. And in aerospace, cost is people times time. If you want to do something cheap, you do it fast.
Yeah.
And Musk is moving very fast. Frankly, not so much with his mortality in mind, but I'm sure simply with his costs in mind. Whereas Bezos just says, well, I'll just put $1 billion a year into this and see what happens. And so he is falling behind. Now, of course, Musk is much more of a risk taker. He skates close to the end of the ice, and he could have a run of bad luck and fail. It's entirely possible. Bezos is much more secure. So in the end, Bezos could win, but right now, Musk is way ahead.
Has anybody from government approached you, Robert, because of your incredible knowledge of space and just tried to tap into you?
Well, I speak with government people a lot. And I, you know, own a small aerospace company. We do a lot of R&D on advanced technologies for NASA and occasionally the military. But, you know, that's my involvement with the government.
Are you excited about our future for space?
Yeah, I am, in particular because of this entrepreneurial space revolution. You know, we've mentioned its significance for Space Force, but it has even obviously much broader significance for human expansion into space. I mean, look, Musk's goal is getting humans to Mars. That's why he's doing this. And he's offering capabilities to do various missions of interest to NASA or the military in order to get his technologies developed and funded with help from their money. But in the course of doing that, he's launching things for them at a fraction of the price they were paying for launches before. So that's a win-win. But he's headed towards Mars. He's developing a fully reusable heavy lift booster called Starship. It'll have about the same capability as the Saturn V booster that we used to go to the moon in the 1960s, which is about 140 tons to orbit from the ground. He already has one called Falcon Heavy that can do 60. No one else has anything that can do more than 30.
Jeez.
But the difference between Starship and Saturn V is that Starship's going to be reusable. Saturn V was throwaway. You get to use it once. Okay. Starship, you get to use again and again and again. Now, I do have some criticisms of some of their, how they say they're going to use Starship, which is they say they will fly, they'll launch the Starship, the second stage reaches orbit, the first stage just goes back to the pad, and then they'll refuel the second stage and fly it all the way to Mars, and then they will refuel it using Martian resources, water and carbon dioxide to make methane and oxygen to fly it back. That is basically derived from my Mars Direct concept, but the upper stage of the Starship is very big, and so if you fly it all the way to Mars and need to fly it back, you'd have to produce an awful lot of propellant, like 1,000 tons of propellant on Mars to get it home.
That's a lot.
I think it's excessive. Rather, I would just use the second stage of the Starship to launch a smaller spacecraft to Mars. And that would only need about 100 tons of propellant to come home. So it would require much less infrastructure on Mars, much less power. It'd be a much more doable thing. And also it would mean that the second stage of the Starship, instead of being refueled on orbit and going to Mars and back and not being usable again for 3 years, it could, after it delivers the payload to Earth orbit, it could just land again, and you could use it again the next week. And you could keep launching payloads with the same Starship being reused again and again instead of, you know, once every 3 years.
Sure. Robert, I have MarsSociety.org as your website. Do you have any others?
Well, my book, The Case for Space, is on Amazon. I think you have a link to it on Coast to Coast website. And it talks about the space launch revolution. It talks about how it could impact things like military space, but also how it will impact our ability to establish ourselves on the moon, on Mars, the asteroids, and reach the stars.
All right, we're going to come back and talk about Mars and also take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.